You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, episode number 116. Writing is a marathon, not a sprint. Robert McKee.
Broadcasting from a dark, windowless room in Hollywood, when we really should be working on that next draft. It's the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, showing you the craft and business of screenwriting while teaching you how to make your screenplay bulletproof. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Now, today's show is sponsored by Bulletproof Script Coverage. Now, unlike other script coverage services, Bulletproof Script Coverage actually focuses on the kind of project you are and the goals of the project you are. So we actually break it down by three categories: micro budget, indie film market, and studio film. There's no reason to get coverage from a reader that's used to reading tentpole movies when your movie is going to be done for $100,000. And we wanted to focus on that at Bulletproof Script Coverage. Our readers have worked with Marvel Studios, CAA, WME, NBC, HBO, Disney, Scott Free, Warner Brothers, The Blacklist, and many, many more. So if you need your screenplay or TV script covered by professional readers, head on over to covermyscreenplay.com. And today's show is also sponsored by the Heart Chart Screenwriting Masterclass, taught by legendary screenwriter James V. Hart, the writer of Bram Stoker's Dracula, Hook, and Contact, to name a few. His unique story mapping system will teach you how to get your script ready for production and the marketplace. To gain instant access, head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/heart chart. That's H-A-R-T chart. Today on the show, guys, we have screenwriter Mark L. Smith, who is best known for co-writing the Oscar-winning The Revenant. He's also the screenwriter of the new film, The Midnight Sky, directed by George Clooney, and many, many more. Mark is easily one of the busiest screenwriters in Hollywood today. If you look at all the projects he has in development, it is pretty impressive, to say the least. I wanted to discuss with Mark what it was like working with Alejandro and Guillermo del Toro and Leonardo DiCaprio and George Clooney and all these really amazing artists and filmmakers, and how he collaborates with them, what his process is, how he came up in the indie horror side of the business by directing his first film, Seance, which was produced by friend of the show, Suzanne Lyons. And I just had a ball talking to Mark. He is a pleasure. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Mark L. Smith. I'd like to welcome to the show Mark L. Smith, man. How you doing, Mark?
Great. Thanks for having me, Alex.
Thank you so much for being on the show, man. I'm a fan of yours for a while. And, you know, I was telling you before we started, we have a friend in common, a friend of the show, of the Indie Film Hustle podcast, Suzanne Lyons. And anyone who's been at the IFH Academy knows Suzanne very well, because she's one of our best-selling instructors, selling courses and webinars. And you guys got a little history as well, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, man, we go way back before I ever had anything made. Right. I'd sold a few things, but then something got to Suzanne, and she was just so lovely, I wouldn't let her go. You know, I just hung on. And so we just, she's just the greatest. And so we kept finding things, trying to put little indie projects together. And it's, man, I tell you, and as hard as it is to put like a big studio movie together, to get all those, it's, those little indies are even tougher, you know. It's just like trying to find all the pieces, you know, because it's got to be just right.
Yeah, absolutely. So we'll get a little deeper in the weeds on that project in a minute. But before we get started, man, how did you get into the business?
I stumbled into it. I actually had a, right out of college, my family had a dude ranch, believe it or not, in Colorado. And it was like 2,000 acres surrounded by 250,000 of national forest. And we were, I mean, so remote. Our driveway, our entrance was a 2.5 mile old stagecoach trail, literally an old stagecoach trail through canyons and over creeks. And so we would have guests come in from May until like the 1st of October. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, hot air balloon rides and whitewater rafting, horseback riding camps, you know, and all
like,
that stuff.
Like city slicker stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. The same sort of thing, just kind of a little more of a resort vibe with the tennis court, swimming pool. But it was that same sort of thing where you got that rustic, they stayed in cabins, you know, and it was kind of cool. But we were only open, you know, like 5 or 6 months a year. And so I had to figure out a way to kill those Colorado winters. And so it was, they were very long, very cold, lots of snow. And so after about 2 or 3 years, I actually started writing stories for my kids, little short stories. And then I realized, well, I just loved films. I just love movies. And so it was like, well, these stories are kind of fun. I wonder if I can combine them. So I did. And I just wrote a couple things. And now this is back, man, this is, you weren't emailing scripts around and everything. This is mid 90s, you know, early 90s. And it was, so I started playing around just during every off season. I would try to write one or something. And then I actually went out to AFI, did a workshop there and kind of grasped it. The great thing from the workshop, that I remember that I took with me was the first class. He stood up in front of all of us and he goes, "You guys all are here because you want to write a screenplay. I'm going to tell you right now, none of you are going to write a screenplay. You all think you're going to write a screenplay. You're all going to try to write a screenplay, but you're not going to finish. None of you are ever going to finish." So that to me was like, I'm incredibly competitive in everything I do, as my family and friends will tell you, a little too much at times. So I took that as a challenge, you know, so I was going to go in. So I started in those off seasons, starting to learn to write. And then I wrote a couple things that I optioned. One, I optioned to a producer at Disney, and then they got like, I would enter in the Nichols. Do you remember the Nichols? I don't know if they still have.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, of course.
Do they still do it? And so I entered, and I would get one like each year I would get into the Nichols finals kind of thing. And so, and it finally got around to enough that I wrote a spec and sold it to Paramount for Mel Gibson. It was the first thing that I ever did back in 2001 that ever sold. And so, so from that point, it was weird because everything kind of changed. And it was, I was super lucky to get it to a guy who knew a guy. It was just like this really weird way, but it finally got to people, you know, that they were able to buy it. And so after that, it kind of, people started coming to me more. And so it was from that point on, I was writing steadily and all the way until, I guess the first thing I got made was Vacancy. I think it was like 06 something. Yeah. But all during that period of time, it was just kind of nice, steady work and couldn't get anything quite made. I was doing a lot of dramas that people liked, but they were harder to get made. And so I actually, the reason I wrote things like Vacancy or Sans or something, it was because horror was kind of big at that time. And it was like, okay, I'm ready. I've had enough fun just selling things. You know, it's like, let's get something and let me see it. And so, so it worked out.
Yeah. That's the thing that a lot of screenwriters coming up don't understand, that just because a screenwriter might have one or two credits on their IMDb of produced things, they could be working steadily for a decade.
Oh yeah.
Making a really good living as a writer and script doctoring and doing all sorts of things. But only get one or two things produced. And I know so many of those screenwriters.
It's true. Even the super successful, like say a Scott Frank, who I love. Scott Frank is just, he's my guy as far as writers. But it was, you can look and you think, I would have thought he was busier. You know, you look through it. But what you don't know is he's doing just dozens of jobs in between each of those. You know, he's nonstop. He never stops writing. And so it's a little deceiving when you just look at credits, you know, it's like, oh, they've only written that one thing or two things, you know? So.
Now, what fear did you have to break through to write your first screenplay? Because I know when you sit down to write the very first one, when you kind of really are kind of clumsy, you might've read Sid Field, you know, you might've read Save the Cat or something, and you might've had something like, what was that thing that you was like, I'm going to do this. Because there was fear. There has to be fear. Any writer who looks at a blank screen is afraid.
No, there absolutely is. I tell you what saves me. Mm-hmm. It saved me. It was William Goldman and Sid Field. And the structure aspect is to me is invaluable. And I tell everyone I ever talk to about it, structure is the thing. Because you're suddenly, if you're looking, if you're really into the structure of a script or a film, you're not looking at a blank screen that you got to fill 120 pages with. You're looking at a blank screen that goes, well, I just got to kind of get 10 to 12 before I get my inciting incident. So I, if I do good characters and good, you know, some fun action, do that, that's 12 pages. I can do that. And then, well, now I've only got like 16, 18 more pages. I've got my first act, you know, so I break it down. And then it's like to my midpoint. And then it's like where I'm going to turn. And I don't outline when I write. I've never outlined.
Really?
And so I know kind of my beginning, middle, and end. But the fun for me is discovering it as I go. And so I've tried outlining a couple times, and it was like actual writing got boring, if that makes any sense. It's because, well, I know what's going to happen there. You know, I already know this. It's like I need to kind of box myself into a corner and write my way out and twist and turn. So yeah, the structure kind of helped me overcome that fear of kind of just staring at that thing. And I think part of it, I was just too stupid to know how difficult it was going to be, you know?
Well, I mean,
and so, cause I was, like I said, I just started writing. And back then it was, you know, everything was through regular mail. And so I would write a script, send it off to people to get reads. And by the time I was hearing back, I just immediately dove into the next one. And so I was writing the next one because it was like, I didn't even care about that one anymore. It's like, okay, what did I learn from writing that script that I can use on this one? And I'm going to write this one. And then I'll send, and I just kept doing it. It just got to be in such a cycle of writing that it just became really easy, you know?
The thing that so many screenwriters and filmmakers in general who decide to write as well, they don't understand the absolute insanity that it is to be a screenwriter. The level of craft that you need to write a solid screenplay is so much more difficult than writing a novel. So much more difficult than writing a novel. Or any, honestly, other than the haiku, I think it's probably one of the most difficult forms of writing invented. Is that fair?
It's funny. It's a little bit, it's like, to me, I look at it almost like a math problem, you know, because I do fall back on the structure of it. You know, it's like, okay, I've got to do this much and this amount of number, you know, this amount of pages. So everything goes there. So then I have to fit the words and the character and all of that into those little sections. So the math part just helps me. The structure helps me, but it is tricky, and people don't really realize, even people that are working in it every day. There was a producer on a film I was hired. We flew over to London doing a weekly thing. They needed a quick rewrite. They were shooting immediately and the script was in trouble. So they asked me to do it. So I go, and I had some friends that were part of it. And so I write, and I'm writing like crazy. And so that was, it's just everyone, you know, it's until you've done it. I mean, it's like anything, you know, it's like, I remember my kids played football and stuff in high school, sports in high school. And I would, you know, I'd be in the stands and grumbling about the coaching and the stuff. And then I did it some little league football, and I'm coaching them. And it's like, my God, this is so hard. Little league, you got to think about everything, you got to know. So until you do it, you just never know. Yeah.
Oh yeah. It's like, it's, I think the film industry, and specifically screenwriting, is the only business where someone goes, hey, I watched the movie, I think I can write that. Like,
yeah,
you don't pass by a mansion and go, yeah, I could build that. Like, you don't do that in any other. No, that's a bridge.
Don't sit at a game and watch LeBron play and say, yeah, I can get out there. You know, I'm going to do that. You know, sure. It's not that hard. No, but it is funny because everybody can write and everybody has a story and everybody can do, you know, so it feels, and to be honest, more people could do it if they had the time. But the huge benefit that I had, what were those 5-6 months a year off, where everybody else is having to work, go to their day job, do all of that stuff. I was at home in the middle of nowhere, you know, and so I could just focus on it. And without that, I don't think I would have been able to do it. You know, it is so consuming and stuff. Mm-hmm. So yeah,
it's very shining, like very Kubrick,
Yeah, no, the writing, it was so much. So I figured I would write instead of grab an axe, you know? So that was
right. Fair deal. I think it worked out better for you that way.
It worked out for me. My wife and kids were thrilled. Yeah.
Exactly. Now, how many, this is another thing. How many screenplays did you write before you sold your first one?
I optioned my first one. The first thing I ever wrote, I optioned.
That's lucky. That's very lucky.
Yes, very lucky. And again, it came through, I entered it in, it was like the Nichols and the Austin Heart of Film and those kind of things that they had. And so, and it was just lucky that somebody stumbled on it. So I optioned like the first two or three things I wrote. And then I got a little cute, tried to do some things differently and be smarter than I really am. And so I probably wrote two or three things that I didn't. So it was probably like my sixth, seventh. Yeah, Devil's Kiss. It was a Western. It was a Western thriller that I sold to Paramount with Mel Gibson.
And the reason I ask is because I always am a proponent, and many people that I've talked to, a lot of professional screenwriters, like, say you need to just write. I mean, that's okay. Just write as many and have as many of those screenplays in your inventory. Like, you should look at yourself as a business, and your inventory and your product are scripts. The more of them you have, so when you walk into a room, you're lucky enough to get in a room. Oh, I don't like this one. What do you have? What else do you have? And you bust out two or three other.
100%, because it's so key, because good writing, people will find good writing, but the stories are so subjective. You know, it's like they may like your writing, but not like that story. So it's so valuable to have those other things kind of in your pocket that it's like you're saying, you know, well, I do have this, you know, and you never know when one of those will click. So,
yeah, absolutely. So now, when you did your first movie with Suzanne, I think that was, according to IMDb, at least, that's the first movie that got produced on, I think it's around the same year as Vacancy.
Yeah, I was actually bouncing back and forth between the Vacancy set and that set. So they were kind of shooting at the same time. So
but you were directing.
Nothing to everything.
But you were directing that one.
It was like, so I had no clue what I was doing. And Suzanne was so lovely to let me do that. I mean, of course, I would never tell them that. But it was like I was following Jeff Schaff, who was our DP, and Suzanne and Kate, and they were just kind of like, okay, yeah, you probably want to, you know, you move the camera here, because I knew the story and I knew the performances I wanted to get into stuff. And the one thing that I realized going bouncing from the Vacancy set to the Seance set was we're shooting 10, 12 pages a day on Seance. We're shooting half a page sometimes on Vacancy. You know, it's like you have so much more time.
Right.
And so I had to, like, I remember the actors, we would just rehearse on Seance, rehearse, because I knew I was only going to have time for like two or three takes. So we had to really do it quickly. And so, it was a really wild year and a half or so on those two.
Now, what was the biggest lesson you learned working on Seance? Because that was kind of the first, like, you were thrown into the deep end of the pool. And I didn't know that you were jumping back and forth between Vacancy. You could actually see the difference in budget between Seance and Vacancy, because Vacancy was like,
I walk back into that stage on Seance and go, oh God, here we are.
Like, it was just like, what? I had to bring my own lunch today, Suzanne? Well, what the hell?
We did have. I used to run, this way to God, there was a Carl's Jr. just around the corner from where, and I would run during breaks to get myself a Carl's Jr. sandwich, because it really was like that. And our crew was mostly film students from, I think it was the LA Film School. And so that was it. There was a point where we were trying to use a gurney, and a dolly, and we didn't have anybody that could do the dolly, so we couldn't do the shot.
You mean literally you had a dolly, but you had no dolly.
We had a dolly, we couldn't have anybody do it. So Jeff, the DP, he's trying to figure out a way, and I'm there trying to do it, but we couldn't get anybody to work. We just didn't have enough people and enough stuff. And there was one day where I walked into the set and the stage, and I go into one of the bedrooms, the college bedrooms, which had been gray, and it was kind of, I wanted this kind of dark, kind of a, you know, just a plain background. And one wall was yellow, the other was bright blue, the other was like red. It was like a rainbow of color. I go, what the hell? What happened? You know? And this guy goes, well, I just thought this was so great, it would make everything pop. And it was like, but no, you know, we don't. And we're shooting now in like an hour, and so there's nothing that could be done. And so now everybody, some of the wardrobe were the same colors, so we're shooting them. It's like the girls there with a blue shirt against the blue wall. It's like we're losing it. It's like, oh God. It's like, okay, move over to the yellow wall. It was just it was learning experience for all of us, I think.
You know? It's like you see those shots with people with green shirts over a green screen, and you're just like, what are you doing, guys?
Exactly. I know. It was so brutal, but it was fun. If nothing else, I learned that. It was weird. I'd never had time to be creative on directing. So I was talking to a director once years later, and it was like, it becomes such a machine. You just have no time. So everything has to go so fast that whereas I can sit with a script and really kind of decide what I want to do and make choices and all of this, you're locked in, you know, when you're on a set, you're locked in, you know, that's it. And so you're kind of, all your creative stuff comes prior, you know?
Right. So then you're doing Vacancy at the same time, which was a hit. It was a hit when it came out because it spawned a sequel and did fairly well. Did opportunities really start opening up after Vacancy?
Yeah, they did. Then I got every horror project right. that they were sending to me. You know, it was all of those. And then I did a couple of those kind of things. Mm-hmm. And then, I did a couple of those things. And then I wanted to do something different. So that's when Revenant, I wrote the Revenant right after Vacancy came out. And
really?
Yeah.
Oh, so that was a script that was that was an old script that he was hanging around then.
I wrote it. They wanted me to do a pitch on it. And the producers had the book, gave me the book. They wanted me to come out and do a pitch. And I'm just the worst at pitching. I just can't do it. I can't tell. I mean, I couldn't pitch you The Revenant now, you know, now that it's done.
There's a bear. There's Leonardo DiCaprio. That's pretty much
like
it.
Yeah, it's like that. And I would stumble and say, well, the bear kills the guy. And they'd say, no, he's, you know, it's like, so it's. It is, for me, it's easier to write. So I wrote the spec, and I wrote it on spec, and then it just turned out really, you know, I got lucky and it turned out pretty well. And so we started putting it together, and we were, God, it went through so many iterations. It was originally, I wrote it for Samuel L. Jackson. That's who was going to be Hugh Glass. And
really?
I ran into Sam on another set and on another movie that I was working on. And I said, hey, do you remember that? Because he sent me this great email after he read the script. He was so excited to do it and stuff. And I asked him, you remember how we used to, we were supposed to do Revenant together. And of course he dropped into some of his, you know, his MFers and you know how that one didn't happen, but we went out with it with a different director. It didn't go, they wouldn't give us kind of the budget that was necessary. And so, God, there were so many iterations. We had several different directors. We had Christian Bale was on at one point and, with another director and everything. And then Leo saw a draft, and then we got Alejandro, and Alejandro came in, and then it kind of all started happening. And then so it was a really long process.
That's something that a lot of people listening who don't know about the business don't understand, is that even if it's an indie or a big budget, it just takes forever. Okay.
And especially what I found was, especially with, like, because I've done like three things, or written three things for Leo. And so the great thing is it's Leo. And whenever he's ready to make it, anybody will make it. The tricky thing is that everybody wants Leo in their movie. So he gets sent everything. And so you can write these things, but he's only going to make one every year or two. So you have such a small chance that you're going to be one of those ones, you know? So it took a long time. Like, we were getting ready to go and the financing to Wolf of Wall Street came. So they did that first. Mm-hmm. And then while that was happening, Alejandro got Birdman financing. So that kicked Revenant back a little bit further. And so it was just, you're just waiting for all these kind of things to align. And so it's tricky.
You got these kind of giant, you know, solar galaxies kind of flowing around. So you got Leo is one galaxy, Alejandro's another galaxy, the project is another galaxy. And we're just trying to get everything to align properly, because if, you know, oh, Alejandro's gone up there. And that's what people don't understand. Like, the second you get financing on something like Birdman, for God's sakes, that's not the most box office friendly film. He's like, I have to go, my friend. I have to go.
Yeah, exactly. No, it is a little bit like waiting for like this perfect kind of three planet eclipse, you know, for everything to just kind of fall on. And it's really tough. And so, so you just jump on it, feel, you know, just be very grateful when it does happen.
So Alejandro comes on, and then Alejandro starts working with you on the script as well. He starts working with you and developing the script. I mean, the concept of The Revenant, you know, with it's awesome. It's based on a true story. The visuals are amazing. Leo's amazing. The movie's remarkable, but you know, that's a tough pitch. I'd imagine that's not an easy studio project in today's world.
No, and that's why I didn't see any way I could pitch it. It was because, you know, when I was writing it, because it was like, there's going to be like, I'm going to write 30 pages where nobody says a word, you know, and it's going to be really quiet, you know, and our star, our leading man is going to just get mangled, you know, so he's going to look rough for most of the movie, you know, all these different things, you know, it's going to be expensive and out in the cold and we need to shoot it, you know, outdoors, there are no stages. And so I knew that was going to be really tough, and it wouldn't have gotten made without like a Leo. It just wouldn't have.
No, of course.
And then Alejandro as well, you know, but you had to have that combination. But Alejandro after Birdman,
right,
you know, with the combination of Leo, that was the key.
Yeah, because after Birdman, because they came out year after year, right?
Yeah, he won Best Director for both. Yeah,
I know. And so,
2 years in a row.
And Chivo.
He's kind of talented. Yeah, Chivo, my God.
Jesus, we'll talk about Chivo in a minute. So he did Birdman, which exploded, and it's still arguably one of the best films I've seen in the last 20 years. It's still, I just absolutely love
it. It's so genius.
It's at a different level. And I got to ask you, man, because you've worked with some of the most amazing people in the business. When you're working with someone like Leo or Alejandro, I mean, they are at genius levels. I mean, their crafts is, and I'm not trying to blow smoke up anybody's butt, but
right.
I mean, they're definitely playing with a different set of cards than the rest of us in a good way, because they're just, you don't make Birdman and The Revenant right after each other and not, you know,
no, unless you got some skills, you know?
Like there's something there.
They're on a different plane. Yeah, they are.
So I mean, you've worked with everybody from, you know, low budget indies all the way to, you know, Oscar winning guys like Alejandro and Leo. What is it like being in the room? Not to say that you're not part of that group as a genius as well, sir. You have done some amazing work.
No, I didn't know. I'm the one way over in the corner. Trust me.
Well, but the writers generally are off in the corner.
that's right where our little stool is. That's where they expect us to be. But it's the thing with Alejandro, he's, and then you combine him with Chivo and what they were going to do, because we were working on the script and we'd do something. I go, Alejandro, I just feel like we can pull that one off. You know, we can't really do this and this. And he goes, Mark, you know, I can do this. You know, just let me watch. And so it always worked every time that I thought, you know, no, there's just no way he's going to be able to pull off that shot and make it, you know, visceral. But he did it, and he and Chivo did it. And then Leo's performance, I mean, and especially coming off of, I mean, you kind of look at, you know, Alejandro did Birdman and then Revenant, and then Leo just did Wolf of Wall Street, where he's just rat-a-tat-tat with the dialogue and everything's over the top and he's doing, you know, getting drunk. And then he does The Revenant, which is all just kind of expression and so quiet and everything. That, I mean, when you can pull that off, I mean, again, like you said, they're just on a different level. And so it was so fun. I'd go up on set and just watch them up in Canada. It was like, just like in awe, you know.
But you were really on set. So you were on set for a bunch of it?
Yeah. It was just as a tourist. Sometimes I would go, he'd need a little, we didn't change it. He had it so heavily rehearsed that everybody knew every move. And so there was really no changing of the script, but he would say, I need some background dialogue here. Can you give me something that's going to happen there? So I'd go to the trailer and do that. But the rest of the time, I'm just standing there watching them work. And it was just amazing. Like I said, I felt like I learned so much just by seeing those guys, what they could do.
And I mean, I saw that documentary that they did about the making of that Alejandro was on. And I mean, it looked like hell, man. I mean, that's a hellish shoot. Like, I mean,
there was a time I was sitting there. It was a scene where Leo's hanging off the rock. He's trying to fill a canteen after he's kind of drug himself to the river. And it is so cold up there. I mean, I've got gloves and hat and car. And he's laying there on the side of the river and he's filling this canteen. He's elbow deep in the water. And it's not Hollywood water.
It's real water.
This is Canadian Rocky water.
Right.
And so he's there, and they would shoot. Alejandro would shoot different angles until he was just shivering so much that they'd have to stop, and they'd put him in this suit with like blow dryers, heaters that would then heat him up inside the suit, and he's doing eating soup. And then they'd go do it again. And then they'd do it till the shivers, then pull them out and do it. I told him, I walked up to him one day and I go, man, this is the only time in my life that I'm glad I'm not Leonardo DiCaprio. You know, it's like, it was the most brutal thing. Again, stuff you don't really realize that actors go through, you know? And so it's not all just, let's hang out in the trailer till we shoot this thing. And well, he was so great. He never complained. There was never one time that he like moaned and bitched and groaned or anything. It was just like, he's just the best. He's there to do his job and do, you know, give the director exactly what they're looking for.
I remember someone saying in the commentary, for God's sake, somebody give Leonardo DiCaprio the Oscar before he kills himself. Like,
I mean, he just did everything. And I mean, stuff that, you know, Alejandro would ask him to do it. And, you know, it's like, you know, Leo's just going, oh God, no, really? But he would do it.
Yeah, and Alejandro's a, you know, he's an intense figure. I mean, without question, he's an intense director, not in a bad way, but he has a vision, he has a presence about him. You know, I've had the pleasure of meeting Guillermo a couple times, and he has that kind of different energy, completely, but has that presence and those kind of directors. I mean, when you're going to make The Revenant, you've got to be a general. Like you can't lollygag around. You can't show any weak. I mean, you're battling the elements and
because everybody, it is like your army is miserable. You know, they're looking, you know, you're looking for deserters at that point, you know, because it is so brutal and it's long and it's cold and it's hard. And so, he had a cool thing that he would do. He had this chime that would go off the same time, every afternoon. And when that chime would hit, everybody would just, even if they were, you know, they would time it so they weren't in the middle of a shot, but if it was pre-shot, everybody would stop. No one would say a word. Everybody kind of just look around, get a feel for nature, kind of, you know, remember what we're doing and stuff. And then boom, go back into it. And everybody was ready. And it was every day. And it was really cool.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And, that's an interesting technique. I mean, it's just kind of like, because you can get caught up in the, not only the minutia, but just the, you know, when you're in the battle, it's tough to just go, dude, look where we are. Look what we're doing. Take a second to breathe.
That's nice. I think he did it for everyone because he knew he needed it as well. I think it was very helpful to him because he is so intense, you know, and it is, you know, there are directors that will go and it's just a job. Mm-hmm. It's more than the job for Alejandro.
You know? Oh, of course.
This is life and death, you know? And so it's important. It's funny because I did something with Guillermo as well. Wrote a script with him and they couldn't be more different, you know,
no, completely. As far as approaching.
You know, it's so, it's so funny and they're good friends and everything, but they are completely different and both so amazingly talented. Oh. They do stuff in their own ways, but it's just, very different.
And how was it writing with Alejandro? Like, I mean, bringing that energy, because you're pretty much a lone writer from your credits. Like, you generally don't partner with other people.
No, I don't. And I wasn't sure, but we got in. It was kind of fun because we would each write things that he wanted to tweak and change. I would write my 10 pages. He would write his 10 pages. And then we would trade. You know, he'd send me his, I'd send him mine. And then we would, you know, discuss which one was, you know, we'd have an argument about which was better, you know, he always won, you know, so, which is, you know, that's what he should have. But it was fun because I got to kind of see storytelling through his eyes in a different way. And also, you know, not just kind of like the lens kind of thing, but also how the character stuff and everything that he would do. Now, it's funny because we made one big change that my draft of The Revenant was much more of a kidnapping. There was no hawk. There was no sun in mine.
Oh, really?
The sun, you actually opened with you see the hands of a little boy and a father, and they're carving this star into the wooden stock of a hunting rifle. And you hear the boy coughing and stuff, and you know he's sick. You're getting just a couple words of dialogue. And then there's a splinter in the little boy's hand, and he gets a couple drops of blood that bleed into the star of the rifle. And you kind of go into the grain, you know, of that rifle. And then when you pull back out, we're with Hugh Glass, Leo now, and this aged, old, battered rifle and everything. Oh. And so my story was when Fitzgerald leaves Glass to die, he hadn't killed anyone. He took his rifle. And so he took the last piece of his son, the last thing that Glass had of his son. So it wasn't my story wasn't as much of a revenge to get Fitzgerald for that. It was, he just wanted his son back. And so it was literally just to get his hands on the rifle. So it was a little different take. So that was the one big change, I think, in the two versions. And everything else kind of more nuances, you know.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, to be honest, either one seems to work.
I don't think anybody's complaining about his version, you know. It's like if you want to go really hit somebody hard with the reason for revenge, or if you want it to be something that is more, you know, a little more subtle. And I tend to be subtle, even in, you know, in dialogue. It's like, I don't want to say anything on the nose. It's like, let me take a few extra lines or a couple extra scenes to get stuff across, you know?
Now I have to ask, I mean, cause when Chivo got involved, when you start seeing this footage come back, I mean, it's really unlike anything that had been shot. The camera was pretty much, I think, if I'm not mistaken, it was a fairly new sensor, everything. I saw some behind the scenes shots of how they did it, you know, with these giant, you know, giant silks across the forest.
No lights. Yeah. No, it was all natural lighting. So it
right.
was, we would have just that little window, you know, 2 or 3 hours on some days where there was light to shoot, you know? And so it was so, that's why it was so critical. They did all the rehearsing and everything, because they knew they didn't have any time to waste. And so, and then to stand there and watch them shoot and then go watch the dailies. And they had a nice theater that we'd go to and watch the dailies and to see what was coming out of it, what Chivo was, you know, what I was seeing compared to what Chivo was finding. It was like, oh my God. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause when you're on set, I know Chivo's insane, but like when you're seeing like what they're shooting and you're just like, there's no lights. I mean, is there an exposure going on?
Yeah.
Is this going to even work? I mean, because to the untrained eye, not knowing who Chivo is and not knowing what the heck's going on and the camera and the sensor and the lens and all that stuff, it looks like it's amateur hour. There's no lights. There's no nothing. Like there's no even flags.
And it was so funny because you walked down there. It was along a river. You walked way out. I mean, you drove forever. Then you'd walk there to like the first attack scene where the Native Americans came in, and it was like you walked back in time, and everything looked so real, and there were so many layers. For hundreds of yards there would be extras walking across, getting water, doing this, and if one of those people timed it wrong, which happened, all of the horses would race through, would get some attack stuff, and it was like, wait a second, that person that no one's ever going to notice, you know, was out of place, would start over again, you know. And so it was just, my God, it was just amazing to watch him do it.
So then once The Revenant comes out, everyone just loses their mind. How was it, you know, Oscar night, you know, it gets how many nominations? Like 11 nominations or something like that?
Yeah, I don't even know. A lot. Yeah,
it got a lot.
A whirlwind.
Yeah. So what is that like being in the center of a storm like that, dude? Because you're just like, fun. I'm assuming you're just holding on for the ride at this point.
Oh, yeah. No, that was it. Alejandro and I just had to do, we went from New York, we flew to New York to LA and back, I guess, just doing a bunch of Q&As. And so it was just he and I, and it was just a whirlwind, and it was so much fun. And it was, you know, we did a lot of it before, like after it came out, but before before the awards, we did a bunch of stuff before it ever premiered. So we knew how much we liked it, but it was still such a different film. You know, it was kind of an action film, but it was an art house film. A little, you know, so
it is.
You know,
it's an art house studio. It's like an art house studio film.
It really was. And so it's like, you know, we weren't positive of the reaction. You know, so whenever we got the reaction, I remember the night it opened. And we're all texting and emails, and New Regency is sending the, and Fox are sending the box office stuff throughout Friday night of what the, you know, this is it and it's going to be this. We were like, oh my God, you know, it was so much more than we expected. So it was great from both, you know, the commercial and the artistic kind of sides. It was nice. It was very, very lucky. It was funny because the title, everybody wanted to change the title at the beginning because it was like, nah, nobody knows what The Revenant means. You know, it's like, let's get something that's simpler and everything. But now The Revenant, you know, I remember years ago seeing it be thrown around on Saturday Night Live, you know, somebody giving someone the nickname of The Revenant. It's like, it's kind of cool, you know, it's going to hang around for a while.
Oh no. You now when you hear the word The Revenant, you just think Bear Attack you just think Leo and eating he ate the salmon, didn't he?
Yeah, he did that. He actually ate a real liver. He ate a buffalo liver, or I think it was a cow liver.
Jesus.
And in that one thing, and then threw up immediately after the camera stopped. It was just rough. Because
wow.
I don't know if he was vegan. I can't remember. He did. It was really crossing a line for Alejandro to get him to do it, but he got him to do it.
Jesus Christ, man.
Yeah.
Now you've adapted a couple of books as The Revenant. Do you have any tips on how to adapt a book to the screen? Because I know that's a lot of, everyone's looking for IP. Everyone's looking for existing intellectual property and kind of things to write scripts about. Is there a way that you approach adaptation?
Yeah, I find, I do the things that there's, whether it's theme or character or world, something about it pulls me in. And I never really go, I don't follow the story, the structure of the novel always. It's like I find the character and then I kind of go my own route with it. And so It's a tricky thing. I mean, I always feel like it's cheating a little bit, you know, after writing so many originals. It's like, God, when you can adapt something, it's like everybody's done all the heavy lifting for you, right. You know?
You're playing at that point.
Oh, yeah. And you're just finding the stuff that you love and then using it and building off of it. And so I don't know that – I think I approached it a little differently than most. So I'm not sure I'm the best person to give advice because I don't follow – I don't jump in where the novel starts, you know, and I don't ever do that. Even with The Revenant, we took Michael Punk, the author's a friend of mine, and we just took little tidbits, you know, and then and my first draft was a little more loyal, close to it. The second one distanced itself a little bit more, but it's just you kind of find the stuff that you love, you know, in a novel, and then and the stuff that works, and then you go with it.
So basically, that's the thing. A lot of times screenwriters will look at a book and you're like, oh, well, it's not exactly like Harry Potter. Like, you know, you missed that part. I'm like, you can't. You can't do an adaptation like that because then it's going to be a miniseries at that point, or exactly. You know, 8 hours or 10 hours worth of stuff. So your approach, and I think the best adaptations is they take the best of the novel in that form and turns it into a new plot, a new format, because it is a brand new story, a new format, everything.
It is. And there's so many things. I actually just ran into this on this, another thing I was adapting. There's so many things in a novel that you can get away with, little cheats, little things that visually you can say something's happening on the page, but if it's on a screen, it's like, wait, no, that's not right. That doesn't work, you know, or a cheat in a plot, that a plot hole that, you go and, well, I read 3 days ago when I was reading, you know, the first 30 pages that happened. This shouldn't happen. You can't do any of that in a movie. So you have to fix those. So there are some novels that I have loved and wanted to adapt, but they had holes like that. They had things like that I couldn't figure out a way to get around it cinematically. So I just didn't do them, you know.
Now, you said something a little earlier in regards to on-the-nose dialogue. Do you have any advice on dialogue and how – because you have some very realistic dialogue in your scripts. How do you approach dialogue?
I try to – my one thing is never answer the question somebody asks. You know, it's like if someone asks, is the sky blue, you don't say yes. You know, you would say the sky's blue, but not like it was – yesterday when the storm was here, or so, you know, we had just blown through, or something that leads to something else. You're always, every line of dialogue should kind of be telling you something about the person that is speaking it, you know, and the events and what's going on. You just want to get that feeling. And because that's how people in real life, you know, they don't, you just, everything isn't just A, B, A, B, A, B back and forth. It's like things flow, you know, and you kind of get off tangent and you get back and you find your ways. And, you know, it's interesting. I'll throw another name, now name drop on you again. So I was doing the Star Trek with Quentin Tarantino. Mm-hmm. And so he and I are working on that together. And when we're talking about, and he's writing this dialogue scene that I've written, and then he writes it, and it's like, my God, because I thought I was like, didn't want to be straightforward with anything. So I'm kind of flowing over here. And then he does this thing, which is now 5 pages longer than my scene was. And he's going all out here and he's touching on stuff that's way over here. And then he comes back over and it was just beautiful. It was just so wonderful and so funny. And so it's like, he just, again, you're talking about someone that sees stuff.
Oh, well,
normal humans, you know? And so,
right.
And I say that with, you know, reverence. It's, but he's just that guy. And so he's really good at not just being straightforward with anything. Oh. I think that, you know, so yeah, clearly. And it, so that's to me is it. You just kind of, you want to take your time. Don't rush to feed information. Don't just deliver information through exposition and everything. You just want to have conversations and then let the stuff come out in conversations. I did this thing. We're just selling. It's a TV show with Benedict Cumberbatch. And I've got these two strangers that kind of meet in Europe, and they're each asking questions about each other and just having a conversation, but neither one ever gives a straight answer. So by the end of it, you kind of know where they're coming from, but you don't really know any details about either one. They're still mysteries to each other. And that's, I think, is important. You just don't want to know who everyone is, you know, in the first 5-10 minutes, because then it's like, okay, I'm just going to follow this guy. Then it all comes down to, and I build everything from character anyway. But if you do that, if you feed everybody, if you've given everybody, the audience what they need to know in the first 10 minutes of a character, then it's like you're relying on explosions or actions mm-hmm. or whatever. You know, it's just you're not really getting into the twists and turns of character. And that to me is like that's the fun.
So that was I was going to ask you, because I always ask screenwriters, do they start with plot or character? And I know that you obviously need both, but some writers focus on the plot much more than the character. But I always say is my personal experience, and I've talked to a lot of writers about this, is like when you think of a movie that you've loved, rarely do you remember – it's like, man, that plot was amazing. I mean, yeah. You could say that to Sixth Sense. Like Sixth Sense was such a strong plot that that's what you remember from it.
But there are outliers like that. Right.
Yeah. But generally, like Indiana Jones, like I kind of remember Raiders of the Lost Ark. I vaguely remember Temple of Doom because it's not one of my favorites. But then I vaguely remember Last Crusade. Like I get the general plot. But what I remember is Indy and his father in Last Crusade. Like that's what you connect to. Or Short Round.
At moments.
Right.
Yeah, Short Round. It's moments. And moments come from character, you know, and unless you're in a Michael Bay film, you know, where it's like then it's like something else. But you need character is everything. And like I said, I always start off with the beginning, middle, end, just two lines. So I know kind of where I'm headed. And then when I start building the character, normally that middle will change. You know, what I thought was going to happen at the middle no longer happens because this character decided to do something else. And so the ending is usually, I'm going to get to the same ending at some point, you know, that doesn't vary as much. But it's all about the character and where they're taking you, you know, and it's a reason why I can't really pitch, because I can't write. I don't know what I'm going to write. You know, I don't know where this character is going to be. I can't tell you, like in a TV show, I can't tell you what he's going to be doing in episode 5 yet. You know, I've got to get him through the pilot. And there was one time when I was first starting out, the only time I ever pitched, it was a job I really wanted. And I had a week to get ready. And so I sat down and I wrote the script. And I just plowed out the script, 111 pages or something, whatever it was. And then I wrote a pitch from the script that I'd written, and that's what I pitched. And so that's the only way I can do it. I have to actually write it. And so,
You said something really interesting, and I've heard this said so many times, and I've read it in so many books, is that a lot of times writers, like Stephen King and some, you know, prolific writers, they'll say this comment where like, oh, the character took me somewhere, or the character decided to do something. And I know a lot of writers listening, I get where that statement comes from, because as a writer, I see kind of where certain things kind of start flowing. But I want to hear your opinion on like, what does that actually mean? Because for some people who are starting to write, let's say they start off with Indiana Jones, like, well, where does Indiana Jones go? How is Indiana Jones talking to me? Like, I think Quentin says it. He's like, oh, court reporter.
Yeah,
a court reporter between two. I'm like, that sounds great, Quentin. But for the rest of us mortals, how does that work? Like, I'm sure, you know, Mr. Blonde and Mr. Black are talking. That's fantastic, you know. But like, how? Like, I just want to know from your point of view, it being inside of that space in your own writing, how does that work?
It is. It's so weird. It's like he said. It's these guys are talking, and I'm hearing them, and I'm saying it. Like my wife will say, I heard you. I heard these lines, you know, the dialogue. She's walking past, and it's like, because I don't even realize I'm saying them out loud, you know, and it's, I'm just doing it. And it's, they speak to you and they change. It's like, I just, this one thing that I just sold it in the first 10 minutes, this guy, this man and woman, they meet, and you think they're going to be this great, it's this love story, it's going to be wonderful. And then boom, there's just this like tragic death. And it's kind of in a thriller action thing. And it's a TV show. So near the end of the pilot, she dies. And that's the way it was all planned. That's the way it was all written. I liked her character so much. And they were so good together that it was like, okay, we're not going to kill her now. You know, we're going to change this, because she just did things that became so important. And she became such a part of the story that we never intended. I never intended that now she is kind of the second lead in the show. So she's going to, you know, it's all going to work out. So That's, I guess, again, the thing that I say, I don't like to outline. I don't want to get too locked in. I would always recommend that to writers, be flexible. You know, just because this is the way you thought you were going to do it when you started, don't lock yourself into that, because there's so many moves that can be made. And if you find, if as you're writing and you find something that, wow, this feels like it's really working and I really like it, that means it's really working and it's probably good, you know, so keep going, keep that person. If that dynamic, you need those two people to really make it work, then don't get rid of the one person. And so, so there's all that stuff, and characters, again, they evolve and they write. I mean, the way I write is I'll write as many pages as I can in a day. And then before I start the next day, I go back and I read all the pages that I wrote the day before. And then I kind of change and I tweak and I do all that stuff in those first pages. And I keep going that way. So I'm always rewriting. And like, if I get stuck on page 40, I'll go back to page one and read all the way through and start making changes. And I just keep doing it.
So that's kind of, so in your writing process on a daily basis, you, let's say you write 20 pages, the next day you'll come and read those 20 pages. And it's almost kind of like a runway to get you going to the next, to like launch it, as opposed to just starting cold, picking up where you left.
I'm already now, okay, I'm with them. I'm with the journey now. It's like, I'm going, I've got momentum. And so it's like, I just keep going. And it's a quick read, you know, because you know what's going to happen and stuff. You're just kind of seeing if everything is flowing and if you bump on anything. And then if not, you just, like you say, it's a runway. You just take off.
And when I'm writing, you know, when I was writing my nonfiction and fiction books, I do the exact same thing. Sometimes I'll get caught and I'm like, where do I go from that? Let me just reread this chapter. And you just start back and it just all of a sudden, oh, there it is. And it just, it's kind of like you're picking up a signal, a radio signal, almost like you're channeling.
Kind of left something, and a little beacon back there, you know, that you get, okay, then I got that, now I can go. But it is true. There are those little things that you put in those first sections that you knew were going to take you to the next ones. You just sometimes have to remind yourself, you know, and just see them again.
Now, another thing, and I would love to hear your point, because you've sold a lot of scripts. You've been working in the business for a long time. And I'm sure you probably did this originally, because if not, you wouldn't have sold your first scripts or optioned your first scripts. With the way that the script is formatted, I've always heard that people want to see a sea of white. They want to see as much white as possible, not a lot of description, not a lot of black, unless, and obviously dialogue to a minimum, unless you're Tarantino, which then you do whatever you want. That's a whole other, And then also before, I'm going to just go side note for a second. People always use Quentin, Shane Black, Sorkin, you know, Kaufman, these kind of giants in the screenwriting space. And they're like, well, Quentin does this. And I was reading a Quentin script the other day and there was some grammatical errors. And I always tell them, dude, he could misspell every word and it's still going to get sold. He's at that place.
That's so exactly right. I mean, you just can't, you don't ever pattern the way you're going to do things the way, you know, Tarantino or Sorkin are doing. You know, it's just, you're not going to be able to. And it's, you do want, my thing is always, I try to be as sparse with words. I get very descriptive in my action.
But short.
Yeah, it's short, but I want people to know. It's like you get one shot at reads and read, and a screenplay can be kind of a cold read. You know, it's like, it's not, they aren't the warmest emotional thing. So I do add flavor. Mine's a little different. There was an exec at Paramount once that told me that, you know, she got a script without a title page and she started reading it. She knew it was mine because it was, the way it was written, there were a lot of, I use a lot of ellipses, and I go and I continue action and then a line of dialogue and then I'm doing action down here and I space it out, but I want people to really invest, you know, because I've got them for a read. And if I have them for 10 pages, if I don't have them after 10 pages, if I don't have them for those 10, I don't have them, you know? No, and so it's like, you've got to be, you want to pull them into the story. And sometimes you just, you know, the description for me helps it more than the dialogue. You know, you can, that was what I was going to say on some of the ones that I kind of got off my path. I got early on, I thought, well, I've kind of figured out the structure and all this. I'm going to get super cute on dialogue and every single person's going to have all these really snappy lines and it's going to sound great. And people are going to love me and think I'm so clever. And what it was every character sounded exactly the same and they were all annoying. You know, it was just like, oh, enough of the cute banter, you know? And so you don't want to do that. You just want to, again, keep people, keep people authentic, you know, keep, you know, keep them real.
Now you've written a handful of horror scripts and thriller-esque scripts in your day. In your opinion, what makes a good terrifying film or script? Is there an element or a couple elements that you feel that
makes it? I mean, you need that kind of cool hook on a horror script, that's something, you know, like A Vacancy, where it's like they're going into the hotel and their cameras, you know, and now, you know, it's going to be a snuff film.
It's terrifying. It's a terrifying concept, because I think that's another thing. If you feel like you've been there or are going to be there, like, look, if there's a giant shark coming after you, like, chances are that's not going to happen to me.
Right.
But going into a motel on the side of the road in the middle of nowhere, there's a lot of people who've done that.
People done that, or an Airbnb now or whatever. You know, you just go and stay, and you just don't really know where they can't, you know. So that to me was that you get a hook, and it's a hook that people can relate to. And then everything goes back for me to the characters. You have to then build characters that you care enough about, that the audience will care enough about, that it matters whether they get through it or not, you know, that you're rooting for them. That, because if they're people that you don't care, you might get some jump scares out of them or whatever, but you're not going to be really, an audience won't be tense. They won't be frightened, because they don't really care what happens, you know, the fate of the characters. And so that it's, you have to write, you know, characters that people want to love, want to protect.
Cause if you think of, The Exorcist, I mean, Jesus, I mean, like, that's one of the, I mean, you want to save that little girl.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, so often that's really what it comes down to. And I mean, any great story is really about, you just want the people to be okay at the end of it. I mean, even if it's like a thriller, Man on Fire, Denzel, Dakota Fanning, which is just, I just love that film, but it's these two characters that you care so much about, you know, his journey and then this little girl and the relationship and then all the other stuff that happens. You're just so tense because you're not tense because the guns are firing. You know, you're not tense because the cars are flying around. You're tense because the people you care about are in the car or getting shot at, you know? And so it's just always, you just always have to remember characters is the key.
Yeah. I mean, you look at something and everyone listening on the show knows that's one of my favorite scripts of all time, Shawshank. I mean, all about character it's about, you know, a guy who's been thrown in jail, and it's in the 40s, 30s, 40s, something like that.
It takes place
40, 50s or something like that. It takes place. And it's, you know, it's a horrible name. I mean, if you think The Revenant was a rough sell, I mean, Shawshank Redemption's even worse.
I know.
But it's all about you follow Andy Dufresne, you following Red. It's all about character. The plot is fantastic. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah. No, I feel like it's a near perfect film. I just love that movie. And it's everything about it, the world, the character, you know, and even the stuff, you know, that was written into the, because I've read the script, and the stuff that you think is just a director's choice, but it was on the page, you know, the vibe of what this place feels like and what these guys were, you know. No, it's wonderful. It's Frank. Just, it's a fabulous.
Frank is Frank's okay. He does okay for himself.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think he's going to make it.
I think he's gonna be fine.
Yeah.
Now, your latest film that just got released a little bit ago, The Midnight Sky. How did you get involved with that in George Clooney?
It was, I got, my manager found the book. It was just this kind of little thing. He saw a book review on it and he sent it to me. And I didn't read it for a long time. I was really busy. And I said, I don't think so. And everything. And so I slipped it to my daughter, and who she and I actually wrote a script together, this shooting summer. But, so she sent it and she said, you need to read this because you're going to want to do it. And so, and she was right. So I read it and, loved the characters, loved the setup, and then knew I was going to change certain things again, kind of like we're talking about it. It was like I grabbed hold of kind of a core there and then wanted to do my own thing with it. And so I wrote the script. We sold it to Netflix, just the pitch. I didn't pitch, luckily, but my producer's a really good talker, so he did it. And sold it to Netflix, so I wrote it, and then it came out okay, and we sent it. We were looking for directors, but we were also thinking about the character of Augustine and who we could get. And we kept thinking about Clooney, and we thought, well, who's a director that could, you know, that could get George? And we didn't think George, George. Wasn't like something that he would do. You know?
Right. And, who could, what's a director who could get George? George. Yeah, George could get George.
Yeah, who knew? you know. But so we did. Yeah. So we sent it. It got to him more for the acting part of it, and then he read it and said, "No, but you know, I'd really like to direct it." So there were a few different directors that were trying to get it at that point, and we just loved the Clooney package. So we did that, and it came together like incredibly fast, and probably. God, 3 months after I wrote it, it was in pre-production. It was like super fast.
I mean, I remember when George came out with his first directorial film, the one about the Gong Show guy, Confessions of
Dangerous Mind.
Dangerous Mind. Yeah. I was so blown away by his take, his choices as a director. He doesn't get as much credit for the directing because his persona and his acting is so, that shadow is so large that the directing almost gets swallowed up. But man, is he an accomplished director. Man,
he really
he's
is.
So
he
does, good.
There's like an ease to it, which I think is sometimes people don't appreciate what the effort that goes into it. Also his acting as well.
His acting is amazing.
He makes it look so easy that it's not always appreciated.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
But,
And how is it collaborating with him?
It was great. It was really great. I mean, it was nice because he loved the script and he didn't want to do a lot to it, you know, like some directors. And then he made some tweaks. The biggest changes, I think, we ended up going because Felicity Jones turned out to be pregnant. She wasn't pregnant when she was cast. And so the character, her character Sully, was this kind of loner who never wanted a relationship. And everything that we'd built was this idea that she was traveling to space and stuff, so she would never have to settle at home and actually have a relationship with another human being. So now suddenly we had our character who was that, and now she's pregnant. And it's like, wait, how's that happen? You know,
immaculate conception.
Yeah, that's it. In space. Whole different movie.
That's a whole other movie. Immaculate conception in space. Somebody,
I'm gonna go pitch that.
Pitch that right now.
We'll do that. That's ours. Yeah. nobody steal that. But it so George was in London when it happened, and he goes, okay, we've got to make some changes. And I was over here in the States, and so he and Grant Heslov, who they've written so much stuff together, I mean, nominated for Oscars and stuff, so they know exactly what they're doing. So they ended up working in the pregnancy angle. I didn't do that one. And so the stuff that happened on the ship changed a lot because it became so much more about her pregnancy, because that was such a part of the story, that other stuff that was kind of built in for conflict and everything, kind of we lost that. But it was a trade-off in some ways, because it probably worked to some advantage because there was maybe a little more of an emotional thing, because now it's like, you know, there's a child that you're kind of protecting for the future also. It's not just a bunch of adults on a
It's fantastic. I mean, you have had a heck of a ride so far, Mark, I have to say.
I know, and it's fun because it's enabled – I just get to work with just the best – you know, it's just really talented people. And it's like all these people that I kind of, you know, walk through just watching their films and stuff, and now to be able to actually kind of interact with them and stuff, and work with them is really cool. I'm incredibly lucky.
Yeah, it's and that's what we were going to talk about earlier, is there is a matter of luck for this. But the thing is, there's no question, because there's a thousand other screenwriters who are really good writers. But the difference is, I feel, is luck helps once you've prepared for it, and once you need to help it along, and then certain things, kind of like a character in a story, it starts to meander, but you've got to give it that push, that fuel, and that's what's writing constantly and getting all those scripts out and putting yourself out there, and that's when these things happen. Because if you don't write those scripts, there's chances of anyone knocking on your door and going, hey, can you write a script for Alejandro and for George? Like, that doesn't work that way.
There's not that much luck. Yeah, no, it's not going to happen. No, I always took it like the old, you know, the old good fisherman, you know, good fisherman throws a lot of lines, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, you're probably not going to get a bite with one, but if you throw out 10 or 12, cast out those many hooks, then your odds increase. And so it's luck, but it's also kind of perseverance never stopping. You know, it's never, like I said, if you write one and then just hand it off and hope, you know, for the best, and man, if I should be lucky enough to get that, it's not going to happen. You've got to keep going, because not only are you increasing your chances for luck, but you're increasing your skill. You're getting better so that the the fifth, sixth one is going to be better than the first one. No matter how much you love the first script, the fifth one's always going to be better, you know? And so it's just the way it is. Everybody gets better when they, you know, use their muscles. So.
And then, and also, you know, work on a dude ranch, obviously.
Yeah, that helps. Yeah. Which was one of the things that one of my early scripts was all on a dude ranch. And so,
Did that get sold?
It got optioned.
It did.
It never got made or so. Yeah. So it did. So but it is one of those things that also helps to write what you know.
Yeah, I was going to say that. Yeah.
Because it's one reason that I've always kind of stayed away from sci-fi. So I don't love writing technology. Technology is, I've always found, if I bring into a story, I use it as a cheat. You know, it's like I want people to have to deal with their own emotions and their own conflicts and their own stuff. And I don't want to have to be able to use technology to get them in and out of stuff. And I know other great writers smarter than me can use it well. But it was even like on Star Trek, whenever I told Quentin, it's like I'm not a Star Trek guy. You know, I'm not a big sci-fi guy. I know the characters and I like the relationships and all this and I know about it. But he goes, don't worry about that. I'll take care of all the, you know, the big sci-fi stuff and everything. We just do that. And so you kind of find what you know and you write what you know. Don't try, especially when you're starting out, don't try to write something that doesn't feel like a fit, because if it feels clumsy, it's probably going to be clumsy at first, you know, just kind of build up to that.
And I have to ask, because I know I'll get shot if I don't, how did you get involved with Quentin in Star Trek? Like how, because I've heard of this story in town that, you know, oh, Quentin's going to make a Star Trek movie and he's writing a Star Trek movie and it's going to be whatever, like pulp and fiction in space. I don't know. And generally Quentin doesn't work with other writers. He generally is a lone wolf like yourself. How did that work? How did you guys get together?
It was through JJ Abrams. And so it was through Bad Robot. I've done a few things with them. And so they kind of bring me stuff. It was like they had a tough script, Guillermo del Toro, that they that he was on. And so I worked on that with him. I worked on with Edgar Wright on a script for JJ and stuff, which was another, I mean, completely different experience, but just as much fun. But Tarantino, it was like he wanted to do this, and then we all gathered in a room and we talked about the ways in. And so after that, they just called me. It was like the day later and said, hey, are you up for it? Do you want to go? And if so, then, you know, Quentin wants to hook up. So I said, yeah, sure. So, and that was where, like, one of the first times I guess it was the first day I met Quentin. We were in the room and he's reading a scene that he wrote. And it's like this awesome, cool gangster scene. And he's acting it out and he's doing the book back and forth. And it's like, I told him, I said, man, I'm just so mad I didn't have my phone like recording at that point. This would be like so valuable. It was just amazing. But, so then it was that, we started working. Yeah. I go hang out at his house one night. We watch old gangster films. I mean, we were there for hours. I don't know.
On film, obviously.
Yeah. In his theater. He's got this amazing, huge theater attached to his house on film. He actually had his projectionist from his theater there on Beverly come and do it. So I mean, it's just, you know, we're just kicked back. He and I watching gangster films, laughing at the bad dialogue, you know, but talking about how it would kind of bleed into what we wanted to do. And so, then it was it. I don't know. I mean, I give it 10% chance it ever gets made. You know, it's one of those things that's so tricky for him to do. It's like if he really wants to, he's got this set limit that he puts on, and he'll tell me he's got an, you know, well, I can say it's not an original, so it won't count against my, you know,
his original.
Yeah, or whatever. And so, but I think I would love for it to happen. My God, I'd just be thrilled if it did. But
I gotta say though, I mean, when I heard that, I'm like, how is Paramount going to give Tarantino one of the most valuable IPs they have? I mean, Quentin's going to do what Quentin's going to do. Like, he's not going to, like, you know, kowtow to studio execs on, like, well, you know, we're going to make some toys. Like, yeah, no, it's going to be full blown open. So how does that, like, when I heard that, I'm like, I want to see it. I'm first in line to see it. But, like, how is a giant conglomerate going to give their biggest IP, arguably Paramount's biggest IP, to one of the most renegade filmmakers of his generation?
It's again, it goes to, like, you know, guys like Quentin can do stuff that the rest of us can't, you know, they can get it. And so they're going to trust him because they know what they're going to get is going to be like something that's going to be talked about for years. You know, it was, I mean, the script is so Tarantino, and it's hard R and it's violent and it's, you know,
right.
It's got all these great elements in it. But, and I guess probably too, I mean, I guess they've gone, Paramount has done different things and kind of veered back on Star Trek. They probably feel like Tarantino's worth being able to veer off path and always.
It could be its own thing. You know. It could be its own thing in the zeitgeist of Star Trek. Like it's in the pantheon. It's not going to mix in with Kirk. I mean, maybe it does. I don't know. I haven't read the script, but
It does. We've got him. No, it's all the characters are there and stuff, and so it would be those guys. But it's like
that'd be amazing.
Almost like, you know, I guess you look at it probably like all the episodes of the show didn't really connect, you know?
Yeah.
So this one would be almost its own episode, you know? And
it's like an adventure. Really, it's
a cool episode.
It's like an adventure somewhere else that kind of doesn't connect with the rest of the.
That's it. There's a little time travel stuff going on. There's all this other. Yeah. So it's
stop,
really wild.
Just stop it. You're getting me excited. Stop it. And I'll never, ever going to get to see it.
I'm making myself more angry that it hasn't.
And the more you tell me about it, I'm like, what time travel? What? What's going on? I need to know. Oh my God.
It's so great. Yeah. Hopefully, fingers crossed, he'll decide that he gets so bored. And he's going to do it, you know?
I mean, God. Oh, anyway. All right, stop. I got to stop. I got to stop thinking about it because it's just going to get me upset. I'm sure afterwards you're going to get – Quentin, what's going on, man? Is this happening?
Or I'll get some angry call from the studio. Wait, what are you talking about, you know?
Exactly.
It's a secret.
So now what's next? What are you working on next?
I am doing – we've got a Daisy Ridley film that's shooting that's the one I wrote with my daughter, Marsh King's daughter. Starts shooting in June, we hope. And it's a little thriller that we're really excited about. I adapted another book for Clooney called Boys in the Boat, and that is it's a true story of the Olympics, 1936, the crew that had to go over to Germany, to Berlin, kind of these underdog things. It's a really cool sports film. I just love how the script turned out. I did another thing, Memory Wall, adapted from a short story that Johann Renck, the director from Chernobyl and everything, he's going to do. And so I don't know. Another thing for JJ. I'm doing a couple things with Pete Berg, who I love Pete Berg. He's just insane.
He's insane.
We're doing this as a quick story, and then I'll get out. But the first, I'd never met him before, and we were going to do this Western TV show. And I go into his office, and I'm just sitting there waiting. And all of a sudden, I hear this screaming, yelling. And it's like, God, what is going on? And it's getting louder and louder and closer. And all of a sudden, the door comes open, and Pete Berg runs in with his hatchet. And he's charging me. He goes, this is the show. This is what we're going to do. This is our show. And so that was my introduction to Pete. And
Did you soil yourself, sir? Did you soil yourself at that point?
I just wondered, okay, sir, sure, whatever. But he's so fun. So I'm doing a couple things with him and something with Robert Redford. He was going to direct, but now he's producing. And so,
it's a charmed life, sir. You lead. It's pretty remarkable.
Really lucky. I'm waiting for like my roof to crumble, just crash down on me.
I have to ask because I have daughters, man. What's it like working and writing with your daughter, man? Like, I mean, I have young daughters, so they're not the stories would be interesting now. Very interesting.
That would might not be great.
That structure might be a little off. But how is it like just on an emotional and on a creative level as a dad working with someone that you've raised? Like, I'm just curious. This is just purely, this is not even for the show now. This is just me asking a dad, what's it like, man?
It was tricky, to be honest. Now, it was funny because we were adapting a novel, but it's about a father who gets out of prison and he's, you know, they love each other very deeply. But he's not a good guy. And so it's really, the story is about her trying to, you know, she has to kill her father, you know? And so there's something, she has to stop her father. So there's a perfect father-daughter thing, you know, all these emotions that, you know, all these little secrets that she had about me, you know, she's going to know, it'll all come out. It'll flow easily for her. But it was really good. She's really good. She fills a lot of the gaps in my writing, you know, so she finds things that kind of keep it going and really good female characters and stuff. So that's good as well. She'd always helped me with stuff. She was always kind of the first person I would send a script to when I was done with it and let her read it and stuff. She went to NYU, Tish, and majored in writing and stuff up there, dramatic writing. But the process was tricky because there would be feelings hurt. It wasn't unlike Alejandro and I, you know,
okay.
It's like, right. We could have our arguments, but Alejandro was always going to win. My daughter and I, Lauren and I, could always have our arguments, but I was always going to win, you know? And so that's just the way it was. And so
you were the 800 pound gorilla in that room while Alejandro was the 800 pound gorilla.
Exactly. I know. I wish I'd thought to kind of do all my arguing in Alejandro's Spanish accent, you know, to really give it some flavor. But it was good. And it turned out really well. And we've done other stuff together since. So it's like, yeah, we haven't killed each other yet.
I can imagine that must be tricky because even when I've shot some stuff with my daughters for school and I'm directing them and I'm directing them in a scene. And it's just like, my wife would be sitting there like, they're not actors. They're your daughters. I'm like, and I'd get frustrated. I'm like, no, you got to do this. And they're like, they're eight.
I know. Luckily, I started very young in college when Lauren was born. So it was, she's older. And so she can take my kind of yelling. It's like, no, you know, structure, this has to happen by Carrie. What are you talking about? You know? It's turned out well.
Fantastic. Now I'm going to ask you a few questions. I ask all my guests.
Okay.
What are the three screenplays every screenwriter should read?
Oh God. Oh man. You popped this on me. See, I would steer people away from a Tarantino script for almost the reasons you were talking about earlier.
It's an outlier. He's an outlier.
Yeah, you don't want to do that because you don't want to pick that stuff up.
right. I mean, you don't want to get infected because
you're just not going to do it as well. You know, so you're always going to be a bad Tarantino. The best you could ever be is a bad Tarantino, and that's like, who wants to do that? You know,
right.
So anything by Sorkin. Mm-hmm. His he's just so clean and his dialogue's so good. And Scott Frank, Out of Sight.
Oh, such a good movie. Oh,
sort of a Clooney film. Yeah.
Yeah.
That thing.
Soderbergh. God, yeah. Oh, so good.
That's
such an underappreciated film because it wasn't a massive hit when it came out. I mean, and it had obviously George, but he wasn't.
No,
Ocean's 11 George.
Kind of hitting that.
He wasn't Ocean's 11 George yet, but he was still George. And Jennifer Lopez was just started to become Jennifer Lopez. And Soderbergh was still started to become Soderbergh as well. So it was a real kind of interesting film. But when you watch it, there's so much style. The dialogue is crisp. It crackles. The cast
is
amazing.
Great lines. No, it's just amazing. No, it's – yeah, Clooney and I would talk about that one a lot because it didn't – to me, it's like it's probably my favorite of his films, of the things that he starred in. But it did kind of miss, you know. It just kind of slipped under the radar, and I'm sure people found it later. But it's God, everybody,
go watch Out of Sight. It's so good.
I don't know on screenplays. I'm terrible at that stuff. I mean, I have my writers, you know.
Who are the writers? Scott Frank, Aaron Sorkin. Who else we study? I mean, you can't go wrong with Goldman, I guess.
No, William Goldman was the guy that – Butch Cassidy was the first movie I ever saw. So it's in the theater. So it holds a special place in my heart. Goldman would be the other. I mean, again, when you're talking about dialogue and kind of stuff and characters, I mean, those journeys he takes. I mean, film-wise, Jaws is my film. I mean, that's my go-to. And if somebody was going to, you know. On my deathbed, what's your favorite? Is Jaws?
Because Jaws has come up so many times on the show, on both my shows, and it is as perfect of a film as really you can get. I mean, it's such a it's a movie made in the 70s. Very few movies hold Jaws. I mean, good Godfathers and those, of course, but and there's others. But the Jaws, man, it just holds so well. And considering we all know it was hell and it wasn't planned this way and it wasn't on the screen, like things just happened. It was all the mastery. It was almost like a possession by Spielberg to get that made the way it was. Because even he thought it sucked.
It was so scared. I know. No, it's funny. And what's amazing is that it holds up with a mechanical shark that was done in the 70s, you know, that now you look at it, you go, God, that thing's so fake, you know, but it doesn't matter. The characters and the story and everything are so great. And it's funny. I bumped into my only time to meet Spielberg, and it was at this Oh, it was after the Oscars. It was after the governor's ball. And, and Revenant just lost Best Picture. And I was kind of in a lousy mood. And I was kind of saying stuff to my wife, we should just go home or whatever. And she said, you better get your act together and appreciate where you are. You know? And I look over and there's Spielberg talking. I go, you know, you're right. So I go over and I just introduce myself and tell him he's kind of the guy that got me into this. And
I'm sure he's never heard that before.
Yeah, no, I know. So he goes, okay, which movie was it? And I said, Jaws. And he goes, okay, so you're a storyteller. And so he just starts going, because he judges people and their kind of what they see in films by their favorites. And so so that was kind of it was an interesting thing, because I kind of like to do consider myself a storyteller, you know. And so it was that's my Spielberg moment and my Jaws moment. And so it just, even Jaws was always there, but it just went a little bit higher after that.
Right. And so Jaws is number one. Fair enough. That's not a bad number one to have. It's not a bad one. What advice would you give a screenwriter trying to break into the business today?
Right. Just write every free moment. I mean, just never, you just, that's the only way it's going to happen. You know, you're, you just have to keep producing content. And then once you have that content, send it out. I would also say, don't send anything out too soon. You know, if you're going to write something and you've got this first draft and you go, oh my God, this is just the best thing. And you send it to your very best friend and they go, oh God, you're genius. You know, this is all so great. I would love to see this movie. Don't send that to any agents or anybody that you really are going to count on, because you're going to need to do work and you're going to look at it yourself 3 weeks from now and think, oh God, I've got to fix that. You know, I always, when I wrote it, I would set it aside. And then I would come back to it. I'd start working on something else. Then I'd pull that one out and go through it and make all the changes that I wanted to make before I ever let anybody read it. And it's really important. So it's, you just want to make sure that you, I guess it's, if you want to be a writer, you got to love writing. You know, and so it's like you're going to be doing it a lot. And so if you find that it's a chore and you don't want to sit down and write the words and look at those blank pages, and then you're probably not going to be great at it, because you're not going to want to do it for very long. You know, and I guess maybe that's what that instructor, you know, that first guy at AFI, when he said to me, none of you guys are going to ever write a script. You think you are, but you're not. I mean, it's probably what he was thinking, because it's just, it's not for everyone, you know?
But there are moments, I'm assuming, even in your writing, where you just don't want to sit down. Is there, or do you always like, there's moments you're like, oh God, I can't crack that next scene. I don't want to go in there right now. I mean, there has to be those moments, right? Yeah, every writer goes through
that. There are. I usually try to have two things going.
Yeah,
so that whenever I slam into a wall here, it's like, okay, let me go over here, because I'll beat my head against it for 2 or 3 days and realize I'm not getting anywhere. So I'll jump in this one, find, kind of get my flow, and then I'll go back here and do that thing where I read through again. It's like, oh yeah, that, and then gets me through it. And so it is kind of nice to have two.
And what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film business or in life?
Oh my God. I'm a slow learner.
Join the family.
I don't know. I mean, I think it probably comes to, if you think you're good at it, it doesn't mean it's going to be easy. You know, I think that's what really took me a while to figure out. It was like, wait, I'm writing this stuff and it's good. And I know it's pretty good. You know, people are telling me it's good, but why isn't it selling, or why isn't it getting made? You know, why are they making this instead of that? And you just have to realize you kind of just have to trust yourself, and kind of the process isn't simple. And so you've got to be in for the ride and know that, you know, that to be patient, you know, I guess maybe patience is the thing to learn, because it's the good stuff rarely happens easily and quickly, you know, and it's, you know, the stuff that you remember. I mean, Revenant meant so much more to me because it took 7 years to get made than it would have if it got made in this first 6 months. You know, it's like, it was such a journey, and these things that you fight with and that you just, you know, so, and patience, because it's, man, ups and downs. So you just gotta be able to ride them all.
I mean, I'm telling you, patience is anytime I ask to answer my own question, it's like, it's patience, man. It's never going to go as fast as you think it's going to go. And it will probably go slower than you're thinking it's going to go.
Yeah.
At every level. At every level.
No, and you can't, and you can sometimes get sucked into where, you know, like, oh, wow, these two things happen quick. Now I've figured out the way it's going to work. So they're all going to happen. No, it's just the next one's going to stop and it'll be 3 or 4 years, you know? So
that's amazing. Mark, man, thank you so much for being on the show, bro.
This was so great. No, thank you for inviting me. This was really fun. And as we're talking, I'm admiring your room. I love all that stuff. But this was so great. And please, next time you talk to Suzanne, tell her I said hi.
I will. Thanks again.
I want to thank Mark for coming on the show and dropping his knowledge bombs on the tribe. Thank you so, so much, Mark. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, please head over to the show notes at bulletproofscreenwriting.com/116. And if you haven't already, please head over to screenwritingpodcast.com, subscribe, and leave a good review for the show. It really helps us out a lot. Thank you so much for listening, guys. As always, keep on writing, no matter what. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv.